This is Marcus Schrenker. In 2009, he tried faking his own death by crashing his airplane near a Florida neighborhood. As it turns out, Mark had a lot to run away from after being caught scamming his company's clients out of millions of dollars across several states. In the days following his capture, Mark was exposed in the media as a con artist who crossed every line to get what he wanted, even stealing from members of his own family in the end.
In my mind, we were going to do this interview,
and
you were going to be releasing the video probably after the interview or when this interview came out, something along those lines. Like, I wasn't realizing the interview was going to come out, and it actually showed up on my YouTube. So it showed, like, I picked up the thing and I saw Schrenker's pick, you know, I saw his thumbnail and I was like, huh, like, you know, there's a few out there, little ones, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. I thought, oh, look at this. There's a whole thing. And my first thought was, wow, I wonder if you knew, you know, I was like, I wonder if he knows that there's a, you know, and I thought I should probably tell him that, you know, that this is out.
Yeah.
That this just came out. And so, but in the meantime, you know, I clicked on it and I started listening to it. And then you immediately mentioned my name. I still didn't know it was you till I heard my name being mentioned. And then I was like, oh my God. And then I was like, wait a second. I started clicking, click, click, click. And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
He released it early.
To tell you the truth, the way the production went was I had this thought that maybe I would wait till the anniversary, like January 11th or 12th or whenever it was, and put it out. Over the holidays though, like I found that I actually had way more time than I anticipated I would to actually get it done.
Right.
And after spending 2-3 months in Marcus Schrenker's head, basically through reading the book, reading the documents, bringing the documents to work every day, printed out, highlighting, just the whole nine yards, I went all in on this video in a way I haven't in a while since I did Crazy Eddie from New York. But, by the time I was getting to that point where I was actually editing the video and seeing the progress, I was just ready for it to be finished, out to the world before New Year's. That was the end of it. So I had always actually had the goal of getting it out before New Year's, but I honestly didn't think I'd be able to meet that goal. And then I think it was on the 23rd or the 24th of December, I looked at my video and saw all the recording I had done and how much I actually had left of my script to edit, record, revise, all that stuff. And I was like, oh my God, I could totally get this out before New Year's.
Right.
So I went ahead and did that.
Yeah, I was gonna say by the time the YouTube recommended it to me, it already had 50,000 views.
I am really impressed with how well it's done. And I had no idea if the guy's actually seen it or not. Like, I don't know. Maybe I assume he's the kind of guy that would Google his own name. Like, I could totally see that. So I haven't had any, you know, feedback from him yet that I can confirm. Although I had one person in the comments, I think it was yesterday or the day before, a very, like, no subscribers, been on YouTube for a while, but has never really done much. And they were like, oh, you didn't post any sources. That's a little suspect, or that's a little sketchy or whatnot. And first of all, I have a credits to the video that lists every single, you know, video, like program that I watched, like Dateline, all that stuff. I listed all the names of the stations and news outlets in the credits. And then I even put in the credits, in the video description, if you want an itemized list of everything that I used, all 63 sources, I have one, just ask basically. But right. I didn't want to just link to a Google Doc or anything like that, that can be traced back to my email, unless somebody really wants it. So whether that was him trying to, you know, poke the bear a little or not, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't put it past him just based off of what I've heard from you and other people I've talked to.
I wouldn't be, I mean, look, I think when you do, or when he does see it, I think very quick, I think he'll probably shoot you off an email talking about suing you and all these other things that he won't do.
Yeah. I've talked to friends who are lawyers or in the legal profession, and I'm reporting a news story that's of public interest. There's nothing that he can really do. And I took care also because, I mean, I found some of what he's up to nowadays. I'm pretty sure he's a photographer nowadays. I can't confirm that, but he's certainly not flying planes, that's for sure. So I found some pictures and this and that, and I made a conscious effort not to use any of it because I don't want to give him that leash where he can go ahead and try to, you know, oh, well, you used a picture, one picture of mine, so I'm going to claim that as my copyright and get this taken down because you're using my stuff without my permission. All the video footage that I used was from television programs under fair use where it's transformative and all that. I don't think he really has much recourse to.
No, he doesn't, but he'll usually make that effort, you know.
Yeah,
and he'll blatantly lie in a letter to YouTube. He'll blatantly lie in a letter to, you know, he can't provide anything. And even if he does, you know, it's like you said, it's all fair use.
And he's got to be careful because on YouTube, if you make a copyright claim, because I've had to deal with this before where people have actually taken my videos wholesale, blurred out my logos, and then uploaded as their own, but they get content ID'd by YouTube and I get an email for it. You have to be really careful. If you say that you're taking somebody's video down because it's yours and you own the footage, it straight up says, I confirm that this is my stuff, blah, 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 under penalty of perjury. So he's risking perjury if he does try and do something and isn't exactly going about the right way of doing whatever it is he's trying to do, i.e. getting the video pulled. Like, I'm not saying that it would be pointless for him to try, because, I mean, there have been plenty of times friends of mine have had videos pulled because somebody didn't like what they put out. There was a bit of a battle, but very rarely have I noticed that somebody can just walk right up, make a pointless claim, and get away with it without, like, even after a little bit, sorry, after a little bit of a legal or YouTube back and forth with YouTube themselves. A lot of times YouTube will be like, yeah, okay, this guy doesn't really have a leg to stand on, so his claim is we're just going to not deal with it. But I think it would be very interesting if he did try to pull something. I hope he doesn't. I mean, it's a headache, but at the same time, I've had in the back of my mind since I started the video, or at least editing the video, that it's always a possibility. So if he tries, I'll just bite him on it. Like, it wouldn't be the first time, as we know, with how he got the book bailout pulled from Amazon by trying to say, the shit that he tried to say.
What's so funny about that too is, like, you know, like, you didn't you find, like, I've been contacted by people that have producers and, you know, production companies who have, while they're kind of vetting me, they're like, hey, tell me about this cease and desist from Marcus Schrenker. And I'm like, I didn't even know he had filed a cease and desist.
Yeah.
I just knew he had filed paperwork with my probation officer and Amazon. Like, he never filed anything with me. Like, I'd never seen that. Other people have told me about it. I've never even seen it.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I found when I was making the video, especially after reading and rereading the book and rereading it again when I was putting together my script, because it was always kind of my anchor where I wasn't sure of when something happened. I just flipped through the book. Oh, okay. Yeah, it was in between this and this. And that would kind of set me on the right path. But what I found interesting was that even after he got caught, this was a guy that was willing, not just willing, but eager to talk to anybody and everybody. And you can see, I think it was the 2020 clip where he's like tearing up a little when he was recounting his story and acting all remorseful and this and that. And, like, I had a couple of people that I know that I would send previews of the video to that said, like, there's just something, like, in his eyes, you can tell that there's a lack of sincerity. And even when he's tearing up, it, like, you don't get that sympathetic feeling in your chest when you would watch somebody else who, you know, has had their hand caught in the cookie jar and is genuinely remorseful for it. He is just basically, like, it's crocodile tears. He's trying to
Well, he's still like, it's funny how he's talking about like, I jumped out of the plane and it was going down. They're like, isn't that weird that you jumped out of the plane at exactly the place where you had stored your bike the day before? He's like, no, I can see how that coincidence is very strange how it looks, but it really what is like, what do you like? You must think I'm an idiot.
Yeah. And it was funny because there's a couple of times in your book where he tries that, like with the Kinney's family CPA. One of my favorite lines in your book is about how he's like, right. I can see where you were mistaken, as it like, he's right. Putting it on her. Like, I caught you. And you're trying to say, I'm the one that's like, oh, yeah, I can see how that would look that way.
Yeah, he said that. He did that to me multiple times where he's like, no, I can see where you're confused or something like that. Yeah, I'm confused because you're lying.
Yeah.
Like, of course I'm confused. You're lying.
Of course it looks that way because it was that way. Like,
right.
What are you trying to pull? And like with like 2020, that tearing up and, oh, you know, like, it was so horrible that I put my family through that. And then the judge flat out said to him in the legal documents that I was looking at and I, you know, obtained, if you were so concerned about how that would impact your family, you sure didn't seem that way when you're actually going through the motions of, you know, stealing people's money, churning people's money, lying about Euro funds or lying about this being a good investment or that or whatever. Like, you really didn't care when it was like, you didn't care until you got caught. Like,
right.
So I think that was, and like, you know what? His lawyer, that guy that he had, Chadwick, like that guy did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
Making that work, how it did for him. But I still got the sense that he almost wasn't even satisfied with that. The strength.
Oh no. He wrote letters to the judge. He wrote letters to, like, he still was not, you know. And even me, he when he would talk to me, it was always about how he shouldn't have been locked up. He you know, it was such crap. You know, let's talk a little bit about you know, where you were raised and how you ended up starting this channel and doing these you know, documentary videos.
So I'm from Canada, Ontario specifically, small town, you know. I went to high school, I had a huge interest in video production from an early age. I took all the classes. I was in a specialized program actually at my high school that allowed me, when I was about 18 or 19, I worked at the local television station interning, making television commercials back when, you know, that was still a thing that happened at TV stations where they would actually have the in-house creative team. So I got my feet wet early on with that. And then I kind of had this idea that I was going to be, you know, an actor, stuff like that. So I moved up to Toronto, you know, the big city where a lot of things are produced. And then I realized I really didn't like big cities. So I moved back to my hometown and kind of bombed around for a few years. I wound up going to university and getting a degree in history. And while I was in university, a lot of the jobs that I worked either had an element of filmmaking. So I worked for a film festival at one point, and or they related to my history training that I was getting, learning. And I mostly studied like Latin American history, Chinese history, stuff like that. So international was always my focus academically, but I found that I had an interest in stories, historical stories that mostly from the last 50 or 60 years. So not really history in the sense of archaeology, digging up bones or anything like that. Like, I was more interested in recent history. And in particular, I was being drawn to stories that I would hear about when I was like anywhere from the age of about 7 to 17, of like weird offbeat kind of stories. Like there was this internet forum I used to go on quite frequently called Something Awful Forums. And on there, it was a comedy forum, but there was a plethora of different topics being discussed. And one of them was called the weird Wikipedia article, or creepy Wikipedia article, or offbeat. I don't remember. Anyways, it was long story short, it was a thread where people could just post interesting stories that didn't really fit anywhere else. So there was one about this group of Russian travelers, I think it was in the 50s or 60s. And one night they were camping and all of a sudden media just swept this party of 7 or 8 people, and they all ran outside into the snow, basically naked, and froze to death. And for years, they couldn't figure out why. And what it wound up being, as I recall, was there was some kind of avalanche or weather effect that basically spooked them, and they thought that they were going to be snowed in, and they had to get the hell out of there before that happened. And of course, being in that mania, everybody just races out without, you know, getting properly dressed up, and they freeze to death. Now, what was interesting about it was before they actually came, like people in the modern day came to realize what exactly it was that was happening, there was all this kind of paranormal stuff that people were talking about, like, oh, the other travelers were reporting that they saw like orange orbs in the sky and stuff like that. Or the other thing was like when they found their bodies, they were all like their skin was all bright orange. But when I read the story, you know, 15 years ago or whatever, it left out the fact that the reason that their skin was all orange is because they found their bodies like 3 weeks later. So, of course, their skin was all orange because these bodies were already
decomposing.
Yeah, decomposing and being exposed to the elements. So it was kind of that almost paranormal, but not quite paranormal element to it, where like there was always an explanation that was logical and scientific in the end, but it would tantalize you with these weirder details. And then I got into other stories, like one of my videos is on a fellow named Jack Chick. And literally how I found out about Jack Chick was I was working at Walmart, and I was cleaning the bathrooms as a teenager, and you'd find these little like these Christian comic books that would tell you why you were going to hell, like Harry Potter is going to cause you to go to hell or this or that. And I was fascinated by this, and I wound up doing my own research into who this guy was that was producing them. And it turns out he's been doing this since like, or he was doing it. He's dead now. He was doing it since the 60s. So, and like in the 70s and 80s in particular was his heyday, because he was talking about how Dungeons and Dragons was going to, I don't know, poison your soul or whatever. So it was all these kinds of loosely related stories that I would read about or find out about. And I found I had a great, great interest in like finding out the actual details, especially if there were like, I would go and I'd, so how I got into the YouTube channel, I should say, is that I would go and look up these videos on YouTube, and there was no video on it. So I thought, after enough times of that happening, I thought, well, you have the...
There should be a video.
There should be a video. You have the training in video editing. You learned how to research historical stuff in university. And you spend enough time working at museums and stuff and giving tours to people. Why not write a couple of scripts and see where it goes? And if nothing comes of it, nothing comes of it. But the first video I did was on a fraudster who stole elderly people's money in Japan. His name was Kazuo Nagano, or Nagano, or however it's pronounced. But early on, and even to this day, I'm not always the best at pronouncing words, because a lot of times I read stuff, I don't always get the video footage of it or get video of it until I'm already well into editing it and I realize my error and go and fix it usually. But anyways, going back to what I was saying, I came to the conclusion that, okay, these videos don't exist yet, but they're interesting stories that I think people got something out of. Like, there was this, my second video was about this guy called Jamake Highwater, and he pretended he was like this Native American expert that came from sub tribe. And I think he even said he came from Canada or something like that. It's been a while since I've looked back on that story, but he basically built a career as an author and speaker, pretending to be a Native American and giving the Native American perspective on things. And it turns out he was like some Jewish guy from New York or something, or California. It was California where he was from. He had like a background, like both of his parents were Europeans. Like there was no Native American blood in him. And then he was called on that, I think in the 80s, after he had already won like the Newbery Medal for writing, like, I think the book was called Anpow that he wrote. And like, this was a book that kids read in like grade schools and high schools in the 80s and 90s. And he, over the years, like there was this guy named, I think it was Hank Adams. He was like this really prominent Native American, like real Native American scholar. And he was noticing all these inconsistencies in what this guy was saying. And like, he would flat out make up things about this tribe that he purportedly was from. And this Hank Adams character started really keeping tabs on him and called him out basically. And then all of a sudden this guy's story changed, like, oh, well, you know, like my birth parents were European, but I was adopted by Native Americans and adopted into their tribe and blah, 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 which I believe wound up being true, except for the fact that he was adopted into their tribe when he was in his 30s or 40s, after he had already written all these books about this tribe that he was supposedly adopted into as a kid. So he was another one of those Shrinker type characters that was constantly making things up and constantly changing his story, however it suited him or to who he was talking to or whatever. So I found that I was zeroing in on a niche of fraudster type characters or unscrupulous characters, liars, basically, a lot of them were. And like the psychology of how they were so good at it was fascinating to me. And that's how I wound up doing Crazy Eddie, which is one of my more popular videos of last year and in general. But basically, Crazy Eddie, how that story came to me, a friend of mine about 2 or 3 years ago was listening to Rogan's podcast, and Joey Diaz was on there talking about how when he was growing up in New Jersey and everything, he'd see these commercials for Crazy Eddie, his prices are insane. That's what he'd say. And what it turned out being was that Crazy Eddie had stores in all 5 boroughs in New York and basically blew up as the first discount electronics chain. And the way he was doing that was because they were cooking the books. Like, they were skimming money off the top of every cash purchase that was made by people and hiding, like, literally stuffing their mattress full of this money. And then they eventually wanted to take the company public. So he sent his cousin to school to become a CPA to learn how they could do it, like, learn how they could get away with continuing to defraud their investors and everything like that without ever wanting to pay back their money. And again, like, the details are fuzzy to me because I was like 6 or 7 months ago when I did that story, but there was this whole, like, I have a 50-minute video on the entire process of it. And it was quite remarkable how much of a science this guy and his cousin had it down to scamming people. And so I guess for me, it's the sheer audacity, and like, all of it is always, there's always a comedic element to all of it. Like, it's funny that this guy, Jamake Highwater, wound up lying his way into being the Native American consultant on a Star Trek show. I think that's very funny that nobody vetted this guy. Everybody just took him at his word based off of who he had lied to before, who had also taken him at his word. So he basically had built up this reputation, got onto Star Trek, and was advising them. And 20 years later, people are like, yeah, that character that he was advising the writing for, there was nothing about him that even remotely could be considered genuine. And same with Crazy Eddie. Like, it was funny to me that he was coming up with all these harebrained schemes for how he could, like, basically steal from his investors and from the U.S. government. And he would, he was such a character. Like, he had his paws on everything. So even when they would write scripts, in a way, for his commercials, I should say, that would basically, he could, they would write things down that they knew he would want changed later on, because they knew he would go in, and he was the type of guy, he was the type of narcissist that would want to always have the final word of the script. So if they knew that they wanted the word breezy used in there, they would use a word that wasn't breezy, but very similar to it, in a way that the writing would suggest that no other word but breezy would be good. And Crazy Eddie would come along and be like, yeah, well, the script's fine, but you need to change this word to breezy. And they'd be like, great, okay, we have the script that we want now, because we basically tricked him using his own narcissism into rewriting the scripts.
Right. We know he wants to participate. We know he wants to participate in some way or correct it in some way. So let's paint him into a corner where he'll come up with exactly what we wanted.
Exactly. And
it's like, I was gonna say, it's like the president picks the head of the Federal Reserve Bank.
It is.
But the truth is, the banks that own the Federal Reserve Bank give him a list of 10 people that he can choose from.
Yeah.
We're okay with any of them. But this way it makes it look like you chose the head of the, you didn't, but.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, we're going to make sure that those 9 other options are so, right, like, by contrast, so unqualified compared to who we want, that you have
Yeah, you're down to two.
Yeah, you're down to two. But yeah, so that was basically how I got my start. I started writing scripts and just editing videos.
How long ago was this?
So 5 years ago as of this July. And it was because I was working at a, I was working at a place where basically I was behind a desk 8 hours a day. And it was a museum, but I worked in the gift shop. And I was behind a desk for 8 hours a day, and I would watch all these tour guides come, go through every half hour, and I would see the crowds of these people that they would entertain for half an hour, handing them tips, $5, $10, and I'm like, well, you know what, I don't think I'm half bad of a storyteller. I might not be Alfred Hitchcock or anybody like that, but I can certainly, I think, hold somebody's interest for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever. I'm going to try my own hand at doing basically my own tour guide type things, but I'm going to do it using my experience in video by making YouTube videos. And those turned into, like, they started out as maybe 12 minute long videos. And then my first one that was over 20 minutes was, I think, about Papa John. Because that was when he was going through his whole media shitstorm of, I'm going to eat the 40 pizzas in 30 days. And that was when he was losing his marbles because they basically took the company from him after he got caught on all those training calls.
Right.
Basically.
Wasn't it racial slurs? Or
yeah. He was doing role playing because he was using some words that people consider weren't exactly politically correct. And he was also complaining because Obamacare was coming in and he was talking about, I'm going to have to raise the price of pizzas by 25 cents. To be able to pay for the healthcare for all white people. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I don't think most people really give a shit if their Papa John's pizza is 25 cents more expensive. Like, maybe, I don't know, the people that eat Papa John's every day, okay, sure, they're going to notice an increase. But at the end of the day, he was making a really big deal out of it. And it was funny seeing him get, like, basically go on the news and just rant and rave like a crazy person. And then the company finally was like, okay, you need to slow down because you might have been the guy who started this company. You might be our CEO, but you're starting to affect our bottom lines by going on MSNBC and ranting and raving about how horrible it is that your pizzas have to go up 25 cents. We're going to loop you into some training seminars, like teleconferences, and straighten you out a little so that you can be a bit more friendly of a PR guy for like a friendlier face for the company. And so in these calls, he was doing role play, and he started just out of nowhere, like bringing up all these racial words and like slurs and this and that. And like to the point where the people on these conference calls are like, okay, hold on. What are you doing here? What if this happens? Blah, 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 blah. And they're like, okay. Like they're just shaking their heads. Like, this guy. And then those calls, as I remember it, either got leaked or transcripts of them got leaked, and long story short, he got in even more hot water, and that was when they basically ousted him and brought on Shaquille O'Neal as the spokesperson for Papa John's after that point. And where you can pinpoint actually where it was that Papa John got kicked out of his own company, because around that time they changed the logo from having an apostrophe in the name, like to imply it was Papa John's Pizzeria, like the possessive, to just Papa John's with no apostrophe, as if that was just the, like, Papa John was like Captain Crunch or something, just some character that they had invented and wasn't actually real. And it was because they kicked him out of the company, and he tried raising a stink about it and saying, well, you know, I started this pizza place out of my father's bar or something like that. And I slowly, the whole story about how he sold his truck and so that they could afford the pizza ovens or something like that. And anyways, the Papa John's one was the first one to go over 20 minutes because it was topical at the time and I wanted to strike on it. But I started realizing that longer form content is where the money is on YouTube.
Right.
And so I realized, okay, if I want to actually start making a couple of bucks off of YouTube, I'm going to have to start making things that are over 20 minutes. And then that led into over 30 minutes. And then with Crazy Eddie, I finally hit the 50 minute mark almost. And then with this video, I probably could have done another 10 or 15 minutes, but I wanted to keep it succinct. I didn't want to, like, I wanted the script to be punchy and I didn't want to go off meandering as I probably have in the last 40 minutes. I'm somebody that needs to stick to a script. And anyways, I found that with like these 40-minute videos, they're a lot more interesting, and people, they seem to resonate more with people. So going forward into this new year, I'm probably going to be focusing on making less videos, but longer videos.
Right. Well, this one's only, so how often do you release the videos?
So my release schedule is all over the place. Like when, so I work a job where basically I'm off in the summers and I have a lot of time to work on videos. I was off last week. So I had a lot of time to work on Shrinker, but it's harder during like when I'm at my full-time job to find the time in the evenings or the energy really to put videos together. So I find that I have to do a lot of my research on the weekends, and the research is always what takes the longest. Once the research is done, I can record fairly quickly, edit the videos fairly quickly, and get them out. Essentially, I have been able to finish a script and then get the video out in 10 or 15 days if I'm going whole hog in the editing and everything like that. The process for the average video, I would say, can take anywhere from 6 weeks to 2 months. Now, that being said, I did one video in the summertime right after Crazy Eddie. I think it came out 2 or 3 weeks later, and it was on some Polish criminal. It was basically the Polish Robin Hood. And that took me 3 or 4 weeks to do because it was an easier story. All the facts were laid out very nicely. And then 10 days later, I had another video out about the judge who sued his dry cleaners because it was a very straightforward story. He sued his dry cleaners for $54 million because they stole his pants, which is the most ridiculous thing in the world. But a lot of times the downtime between videos comes from me because I'm very discerning with the topics. I get a lot of topic suggestions, and I court topic suggestions from people, but I always say like there are no guarantees. Like, so there's a lot of topics I won't approach. So anything involving like child abuse, animal abuse, I stay away from because I don't want to profiteer off of that. And quite frankly, it's an uncomfortable topic to talk about in the first place. So I don't really do those kinds of videos. Now, early on, I did do a video about a troubled teen help center. That one was a little bit different because it was a lot of people after the fact coming out and wanting to say their side of the story and expose basically this place because it was funded by like Hollywood, like B-list Hollywood celebrities from like the 50s and 60s were pouring all kinds of money into this place in the 70s and 80s. And basically I found a web forum where people came together and were like, yeah, I was there too. Like I was here from 71 to 73 and this is what I dealt with and this and that. So that one was a little different because I found actually there were a few people that I had been in touch with directly that were on board with it. So I thought, okay, I'll do this. But again, that was early on in the channel before I kind of established those rules for what I am and am not willing to cover. So a perfect example of a video I was going to do, and then I did some research and dropped at the last minute from actually just before Shrinker, was I was going to do a video on this guy called Lobster Boy. A Lobster Boy had...
I know Lobster. Gibsonton, Florida.
Yeah, yeah. He had ectrodactyly, which basically made his hands, like the fingers all fused together like lobster claws, right? And it was a very entertaining story up until it got to the point where it was like, yeah, he smacked his kids around, he smacked his wife around, and he was pretty ugly about it too. So it wasn't just like him yelling at them or getting all... pissy and just being a angry loudmouth. He was actually quite physical, and that was a substantial part of the book that I had read that was kind of my primary source on the topic. So I kind of decided, you know what, this is a little too dark for my taste. I'm going to go ahead with a guy that instead stole millions of dollars off of elderly people and hardworking pilots.
You didn't do Lobster Boy?
I mean, there's always the possibility in the future that I could revisit it, but for now... Sure.
When that whole thing was going on, the chick that I was dating, that I dated for about 4 years, by the way, and I was engaged to be married to her, her mother was a secretary at the law firm that represented Lobster Boy.
Oh, no kidding. That's hilarious. So you have like a direct connection to the story.
Yeah. Yeah, because initially the when you know he was killed, and that and the video came out where they're showing him like abusing the kids, right?
Yeah.
And then later they find out they get the audio.
Yeah.
And you find out that's not what was happening in that video.
No. It was a lot different.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is the only so that particular video with the audio I found online on some archive website that archives old news stories and stuff like that.
Right.
But to get access to the video, it was something like they wanted a huge amount of money for like 20 to 30 seconds of footage. Like I think they wanted over $1,000 for it. And I thought, you know what, with how much this video might make, I could justify that later on in my life, in my career. Like if I have five videos that are all making $5,000 in a year, well then yeah, dropping $1,000 on a video is nothing if I'm going to get that return on my investment in the end. But it's still like, I'm still at a stage right now where it's shaky. Like I did a 33 minute long video on the cat lady that got all that surgery to make herself look like a feline because her husband was cheating on her and she was a billionaire. Like she's still around and she's nuts. Like I'll straight up say, I think that this lady is a little kooky. You have to be to get all that surgery. But she like that video only made a couple $100 and it's been out for like 3 or 4 months. So if I would have dropped $1,000 on that, I would be $700 in the hole. And I'm like one person. So any money that I make off of the channel usually goes back into the channel, but I can't really justify myself paying out of pocket $1,000, especially right now in the current, financial climate, justify paying $1,000 for 30 seconds of footage on a video that might make $100. Now, Lobster Boy might do famously. I might make $10,000 from it, but there's still the issue. I would want to find an angle to the story that more emphasizes, like less emphasizes the really dark shit he did and more the dark comedy of how the chain of events led to him, you know, shooting his son-in-law and then getting shot himself a few years later.
Well, I think that a part of it would be Gibsonton, Florida is basically it's a carny town.
Yeah, like that's what I heard.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of odd people.
Yeah.
Like it's a very, very inexpensive place to live. And it's filled with these people that, you know, they follow like the circuses, you know, the traveling circuses and carnivals and
yeah.
You know, so they're carnies and they, you know, they're there, they work a few months here, a few months there, a few months here, and they leave for months. And then they live in trailers and it's an odd situation, huh?
They're people up the road and
yes.
That's kind of like their vacationing town or when they're in their off season where they kind of, their base of operations is from the impression that I got from it.
Right. That's a base of operations. That's definitely the way. So, you know, it's a very transient area with a lot of odd people.
One thing I found remarkable that I had read about when I was reading about Gibsonton in preparation for the aborted video was that it was interesting to me how they emphasized that this community truly is a community where everybody was looking out for each other. And like they were more tightly knit than most affluent communities that you see in Canada or the United States. Like these people were really, truly looking out for each other's best interests.
Yeah, they're on the fringes, you know what I'm saying?
They're on the fringes, yeah.
So they tend to stick together because they feel like it's them against everybody else, probably. Exactly.
And it's actually reminiscent. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie. It's from the 30s. It's called Freaks. And it's where the Gobble Gobble One of Us, like from The Wolf of Wall Street. That's where that came from. And basically the point of the movie, from what I recall, is that it's this girl that meets all these people that at first your impression is that they're lowlifes, they're weirdos, they're freaks, as the title implies. But over the course of the movie, you really come to an understanding that they have a better heart than all the scumbag rich people that go and gawk at them and point at them and go and, you know, take the piss out of them and everything like that. they're better people at the end of the day than these people that are supposedly the civilized, affluent people that are, what's the right word for it? The so-called good people of society really aren't that good in comparison to the so-called freaks of the movie. And that was, it was, so when I was reading about Gibsonton, it brought me back to that film. And I thought, that's also an interesting angle that I would try and incorporate into a Lobster Boy video, because he kind of, there was mixed opinions on him. Some people said that he was the nicest guy ever when it came to taking care of his, like his employees and his people that worked for him on the road. Cause he actually came, he was quite a shrewd businessman. And, had he not always been on the sauce, he probably could have made quite a name for himself as, you know, a very successful cardi, for lack of a better way of putting it. But because he was an alcoholic and he couldn't get off the sauce, that basically led to his downfall. And most of his violent outbursts he did have were a direct result of that. So I would think that would be an interesting angle to weave into it. Was like, there were a lot of people that understandably thought he was a piece of shit, but at the same time, there was a lot of people that spoke very highly of him based on, and like pallbearers at his funeral that said, what he did with his family was god awful, but he always did right by us. So I think that duality is interesting. And there was some of that duality too, I found, when I was researching Schrenker, especially after Schrenker's, like those early days where people, like, he was still missing and not, there wasn't the manhunt for him like they thought there was. Like the first day after he left, and people were coming out of the woodwork to say, like, it's terrible. Like, I know that he had some troubles, but I can't believe it would lead him to do this, blah, blah, blah. And then a few days later, you had Tom Britt come out and say, I could totally see. Like, he was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
basically. Right.
But
real quick, how did you even get on to Schrenker? How did you even stumble across this story?
There's a gentleman who's been a patron of my channel pretty much since, I think, the first or second video. And he's been, like, one of my biggest supporters all along. And he actually, one night, I was having a few drinks online with and just chatting with him. And he said, you're always looking for stories that are basically news stories from 10 or 15 years ago that people might vaguely remember, but there's a much deeper story to. He said, I remember this story happening. Here's the Wikipedia article. Have a quick skim through that, because it's basically, the Wikipedia article for Schrenker is quite small in comparison to the whole story. Like, it's a couple of paragraphs. And he basically said, I have a feeling there's much more to this story. Go ahead, read the Wikipedia article and tell me what you think. And I read it and I thought, there's something more here. And that was what set me off initially, was that potential for, I thought, like, you could take the Wikipedia article and maybe make an 8 to 12 minute long video, like the kind we were talking about earlier that you would see. And upon reading the sources for the Wikipedia article and all the stuff that was left out, I was like, okay, there's some interesting things going on here. Like, and there's a lot more digging I could do. And I saw the potential initially for a 20 minute long video. As I was doing the research into it, I came across Bailout, and I came across quite a few older sources, like the Dateline and 2020 and all of those things. So initially, before I had bought Bailout, I think I read the excerpts or the condensed version that you have on the website.
Right.
And I read through that and I was like, okay, I need to get a copy of this book, but I also need to get in touch with this Matthew Cox guy, because he sounds like somebody that would have quite an interesting insight into the story, which he did. And so we got chatting that way. But while I was watching the Dateline and the 2020, and there was, I think, the episode of Who the Bleep Did I Marry that Michelle was on.
Right.
Piece of the puzzle. Like, so over that, well, probably 90 minutes worth of video that was there, each one had something that the others didn't have. And that led me to believe, okay, there's got to be a paper trail or something like that that connects all these dots and can actually be spun into a full narrative. Because the video that was put out by the Indianapolis insurance commissioner or whatever, it was like a series of three vignettes of three criminals from Indiana. And he was one of them, of course. And it basically talked about the financial side of it. but it didn't really get too much in depth with the actual people that he affected. Then the Dateline video, that was where we got the side of the story from, who was it? Smith. And Kinney, like they had, Charles Kinney actually was on that video, and that was where he talked about meeting the kids, the more intimate side of their relationships, and how he would, Marcus would basically insert himself into people's lives. And that was another thing that I found very entertaining about the portion of the book that you had where he was talking about how he got the list of the pilot names, and like by driving down to the airport and basically schmoozing and giving the pity party about, oh, I'm a college student, my thesis is going to be impossible to do without this, and blah, 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 basically playing the con game. And then taking that to the next level and actually phoning up the pilots. And my favorite part is where he would be like, good afternoon, Captain. And like he was greasing the wheels with everybody to get exactly what he wanted. But the fact that he was able to do that over such a long period of time, like 10, 15 years, where like Charles Kinney said, like I went to his house and I met his wife and I held his newborn child and stuff like that. I found that really,
While Shrinker's ripping him off.
While Shrinker's ripping him off, like, and lying to his face at that and saying, oh, yeah, we got some great investments. Or, oh, yeah, your parents, they'd be really smart to invest in this thing that's not going to pay off for 15 years, except I'm not going to tell you that part. But
well, you know, what's funny is he would say whatever he had to say. Like, after 9/11, he was telling people, well, you know, with terrorists and things of that nature, the best place to put your money now with all the terrorism is this. Like he's using whatever scare tactics he can to get you to do what he wants with your money so he can make a commission and have access to the money. Once he had access to the money, now you have a real problem.
Oh, yeah. And the remarkable thing is that he would then turn around and in court when he was getting all these lawsuits from all these companies after 9/11 that wanted to pull out or were getting a little annoyed with him because things were understandably not doing as well financially and these lawsuits were piling up. That was his very defense as well. You know, people are spooked by the 9/11 market. Meanwhile, he's spooking people into investing against their own interests while turning around and telling the court, yeah, nobody wants to do business right now because of this thing. And it's a really terrible thing, but that's why my business isn't doing well and why I shouldn't be on the hook for this.
Right.
And like, the amazing thing to me, too, is that there were warning signs. Like when he got arrested in 1992 for selling the fenced jewelry. That guy should never have been allowed. Like it was
Claiming bankruptcy.
Yeah. And claiming bankruptcy. And
twice. How are you a financial manager?
Like almost a third time, right before everything came crashing down around him. And that guy should never have been allowed to handle people's money after being caught selling
stolen jewelry.
And then the other things you hear about, like something I didn't touch on that much in the video, was how his father was the superintendent for the school board that he eventually got moved into after the whole incident with the stepfather. And there was a news article, I'll never forget it, one of the first news articles I read about was how, oh yeah, Marcus used to get into a bit of trouble as a kid. Like he installed a water cannon on the back of his father's pickup truck so that he could shoot water at all the kids in the neighborhood, spray them down with it. And I'm like, okay, so right off the bat, this is telling me that this guy was a bit of a dink, really. And somehow he was always able to schmooze his teachers and lie to get out of class. And eventually, like, I don't know, but Purdue University is probably not cheap to get into.
No, I mean, I was going to say, he's not stupid. Which the problem is most pathological liars, I think, are probably intelligent. Yeah. You know, the problem is they get such a thrill out of lying to people.
Yeah.
You're fooling people.
They chase that high of, oh, I pulled the wool over somebody's eyes, rather than just being calculated about it. Because you could be a pathological liar and nobody ever find out if you're intelligent about it. And he could have easily done that and probably still been getting away with managing people's money and, you know, skimming a little off the top, maybe not living in a 5-bedroom home, but maybe a 3-bedroom home. And maybe he doesn't own 5 planes. He owns 1 plane, but he could quite easily have gotten away with everything he did had he just been a little more discreet and not.
That's not this guy.
No, it's that's the character flaw.
I wish you could have a 30-minute to an hour conversation with him.
I would have relished that. I almost was tempted to reach out to him, but by the point where I felt like by the point where it dawned on me, maybe you should get in touch with Marcus and hear his side of it. I had already devoted so much time to the script writing that I was like, yeah, I don't want this video like him tanking this before I'm even done it because I've already put so much time into it. But I would relish a 30-minute to an hour conversation with him to hear his side of it. Because, I mean, obviously, he's going to have his own side of it. And he, I'm sure, to this day, feels like he didn't do anything wrong. And that's where the interesting part of it comes, is that, yeah, he was a pathological liar and he lied to a lot of people. But in his mind, does he truly consider every single little thing he said a lie? Is he even aware that he's lying 90% of the time? I'm sure he's aware that he's lying or that he's calculating about it, but I almost get the sense that he's been lying for so long that if he tells you that he, like, to your face, that he's got a green Cadillac and it's actually more of a blue color, it's not even dawning on him that that's a lie. That's just him saying something to you.
Yeah, he has no guilt. There's no empathy. He doesn't understand. He's one of those guys that is watching TV and everybody in the room laughs at a joke and he sees them laugh and then he goes, because he sees everyone laugh, but yeah. He didn't get the joke.
But he doesn't want to look like a stupid one.
Right. He's very good at mimicking what he thinks the proper response is.
Yeah. Like that mirrored behavior. This is a guy that lying in the hospital, he's recovered from the self-inflicted slash wounds on his wrist. Lying in the hospital under guard, calling up a stepmother saying that his arm got ripped off in the plane crash. Like,
what about when he was being sued and he told them that he had multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, Or what was it? Didn't he also say that he had colon cancer or pancreatic cancer or something at some point?
He'd say anything he had to get you to do what he wanted to do. That was when he was selling something to a client.
Yeah.
And the client told him that he had, you know, whatever, pancreatic cancer. And he said, oh my Lord, I have it too. Like, it was like, it's what?
Almost like this twisted Munchausen that he has where, like, it's almost second nature for him to just blurt out, well, yeah, I have cancer too. Like, even if he would have done it anyways, to scam the person, it comes off to me almost like he hears it and he's like, yeah, me too. Like, I totally have that without even realizing.
He wants to make that connection. And then the moment the person's like, and you're working, he's like, you know, I talked to my wife and my kids about it. And the truth is that I could stay home and drive them crazy for the next, you know, 6 months to a year. But the truth is I love what I do so much. I love helping people. I love the, you know, and you know, he gives this whole spiel where the guy feels bad for if he doesn't, but then the guy's a scumbag if he doesn't buy his part, what he's pitching, because we both have cancer and you're still working and I'm not, and you're doing it because you help people because you think this is the right thing to do, and gosh darn it, I'm gonna buy this product from you.
Yeah, like it's insidious how even after the fact too, like he's standing in that courtroom and they're just listing off, like, remember the time you stole from your aunt, remember the time that you lied about having MS, remember about the time that on Dateline you told them X, Y, and Z, and we're proving to you right now because we have videotape evidence of you contradicting this. Remember the time that you said that your arm got torn off, even though, like, it's a very obvious thing. Like, nowadays, he would have probably had that call with his stepmother through FaceTime or whatever. He wouldn't have been able to straight up say that his arm got ripped off, but it's all stuff that's so easy to prove him wrong about, and yet he still does it. And it's that pathology to it that makes it so interesting to me. That is there really a way to like undo that in somebody? Like, can he ever get out of that?
No, he can't. There's no medication. There's no, like, there's medication that can help them kind of control it,
mm-hmm.
but they don't want to take it. It's like a It's like bipolars. They don't want to take the medication, or schizophrenics. They don't want to take the medication. You know, it makes them feel weird and they don't feel themselves. And it kind of, you know, makes them, it mellows them out, but it eliminates those highs. So they love the highs.
Yeah.
That's why they do what they do. So you just took the highs away. I understand it's detrimental to me, but I love the highs. So they're like drug addicts.
That's totally what it is. It's an addiction to them. And it's remarkable to me. Like I said earlier, I found out that from a comment, now I can't verify this. I looked into it myself, but I couldn't find anything that actually confirmed it in any, court receiver documents or whatever, or search engines online. I couldn't find anything about his brother suing him in 2016, but according to one of my viewers, that's what happened. And I pressed for details and I haven't gotten any yet, but,
He's been arrested multiple times.
Yeah, and he was arrested in... Now, the only reason I didn't put this in the video, because it was literally one website that looked like anybody could have built, like, created it and just taken an old mugshot of him and thrown it up. But it said that he got arrested in 2022 for... about 2 years ago for domestic battery, I think is what it was.
Twice. He actually got arrested because I don't know why you couldn't find it. I actually had gone to the sheriff's website and pulled up the photos of him, but I don't remember where it was. And I actually had told, I think I told you, I'd contacted that guy that I told you about, and he gave me the name of the sheriff's website and everything where I had pulled it up. Maybe the charges got dropped and Shrinker got them to take it off the website or something. I don't know. But I mean, I saw the arrest photos. I saw what he was arrested for, the whole thing.
I talked to that same fellow briefly as well. He had mentioned that there was something along those lines. And he went into just slightly more detail, but for whatever reason, he wasn't able to give me the full details of it. So I didn't pursue it too much because at the end of the day, I ended the video off on a note of hopefully he changes his ways, but don't anticipate it, right?
Right.
So without dwelling too much on stuff that I couldn't get actual details for, like if I could have got, like if there was a news article about it and then also the court documents about it, it would have been terrific because I could have said, okay, well, this is what was in the news about it.
Right.
This is the note we're going to end it off on, that this is still ongoing. But aside from, like, all I had really to go off of was speculation, because it just said, like, if I look up the website, it just said something along the lines of domestic battery. And there wasn't any details beyond that, which is unfortunate, because, again, that seems like something, given his history, that should be more... like out there in the media. Yeah. So sorry. The website that I found was called Mugshots Zone. And that was the only place I could find online, despite all the Googling and all the searching I did. He was arrested in Santa Rosa County, they say. And it was on battery, domestic violence. Bond was $1,000. Nothing beyond that could I find. So it's unfortunate because it would be interesting to know exactly what was going on.
But, right.
I don't think that just based off of your coda on your website about what's going to happen the next time he scams some unfortunate person, I don't think you're too surprised by finding out that he's been arrested for.
Yeah, I would not be shocked if at some point he's not rearrested for scamming somebody. And this is just, it's in his nature. He's not going to change. I mean, these people don't change. They just keep doing what they do until eventually they get a little bit better at it, but eventually he'll steal from somebody else and get arrested again. And
he's already remarried from what I've been able to find out. Yeah. So like,
yeah, I'm sure he's taking her for everything she's got.
Yeah. That's unfortunately, like we wish everybody all the best, obviously, but based off everything that's in front of us,
right.
Yeah, I sure wouldn't be investing my money with him, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny is he, when he was at Coleman, he's telling people that, you know, he was just like you went over in the video that he had worked for NASA. Yep. He had interned for NASA. He worked for NASA. He that he was a fighter pilot, you know, that he was, I mean, all these ridiculous things that people are telling me. Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. Marcus flew in Desert Storm. Marcus was in the invasion of Afghanistan. Marcus was an, I'm like, none of that's true.
Yeah.
You know,
but the number, like, the timeline doesn't matter.
Right. And so, you know, writing that book about him was so difficult, but it's funny. I was telling my wife, I was like, it's really too bad that it's not on Amazon. You know, it's on Barnes and Noble's, but it's too bad it's not on Amazon, because that book, when I first released it, was selling great. And it's out of all the stories I've written, it's probably it's up there. It's one of the best.
Oh yeah, like I read the book three times, I think, over front to back, not just including flipping through it. And it's a hell of a read. Like, I've told every single person that I know that reads books, like, on a regular basis and just consumes books, you should get this book, because even though I've done the video on it, your spin on it, your take on it is so refreshing and unique as far as true crime literature goes, because you actually did time with the guy.
Right.
It's like, anybody that's a fan of true crime should have a flip through it, because it's funny too. Like, it's really right. Funny.
Well, you know what's so interesting about it is that, like, the nice thing about being locked up with these guys is there's no way a normal true crime writer could spin the amount of time. Like, nobody else was going to get that story out of him.
No.
Because nobody else can spend the amount of time that it took to spend. Nobody else, like, it's just not, unless you're, you know, Ben Mezrich.
Yeah.
You know, and you're able to spend, you know, a year writing a book and really engross yourself, because you're already a multimillionaire, so you can spend a year on your next project. Like, nobody can spend the same amount of time I was able to spend. And even Ben Mezrich can't spend that much time with the other person because they have a life.
Yeah.
But Shrink, we were in prison. We don't have lives.
You're there. You may as well make the best of it. So
I'm writing, and then I'm talking to him for 2 or 3 hours. I'm writing, and then I'm talking to him about it for 2 or 3 hours. I'm writing, and then I'm ordering documents, and I can wait for the documents to come in because I have plenty of time.
You got all the time in the world. Yeah.
Right.
And I found that out of all the videos I've done, this was probably one of the ones that drained me the most, just – like, I don't want to say mentally draining, because it's like I wasn't emotionally impacted by it or anything like that, but like, it takes a lot of, like, when you're not somebody who's a lawyer or somebody who's in business, parsing through all this stuff, boiling it down to the layman, like, it's I'm sure you remember from writing it, like, it's a lot of information to take in, process. And then
what about those letters that he was writing telling them, everybody, he had sold his house, he packed up his stuff.
I don't like money anymore.
I don't like money. I mean, so the lies are so overwhelmingly, you know, apparent and just disgusting. It's like,
yeah,
you can't, like, the stuff he says is so just, you know, it's like that. You must think I'm a fool.
Yeah.
And for you to even say that.
In the same breath, going and like talking to Kenny's one friend who's like, he's really close with, saying, oh yeah, this is everything Heritage is offering for 2007.
Right. You mean the company that they just closed?
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I was a little confused about the whole, like, so there was Heritage Wealth Management. There was another company called Heritage. Yeah. And then there was Icon. And I was.
I was going to say, at some point I explained that. I do a footnote where I explain that I consolidated all of them because he changed the names of his company so often.
Yeah.
I just went with Heritage Wealth Management.
That's what I did as well.
Right. And stuck with it, because otherwise you have to constantly explain. Keep in mind, he's now closed this company and he started this one, but it's the same basic company. Yeah. You know, so I didn't want to do that to the reader. It's also difficult when people start, you know, they're constantly changing names.
Yes.
You know, so you, a lot of times you say, I'm going to pick one name. And I did that with another book I wrote on Frank Amadeo. He had several companies under the umbrella of one company. And so it's like, this one was defrauded and this one was defrauded. This one did this and he closed this one and opened this one and transferred. So I just went with, this is the company.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you put a footnote, it's too confusing for me. If I were to tell you how to do it, it would be so overwhelming and confusing. It would take away from the overall story arc.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to do that. So,
and that's kind of why I streamlined some of the details towards the end too. Cause there were other things like Michelle being on the hook for, you know, her role in it, all of it. Like, I could have gone into maybe a little more detail about that, but at the end of the day, the video was about Mark.
Right.
And that was another thing too, actually, that I found interesting is he goes by Mark Schrenker now. He went by Mark in a lot of the documents I found and stuff like that, or video or whatever. He was calling himself Mark. But then sometimes, like, so the media always referred to him as Marcus. And then other times, like, he'd be dealing with a different set of clients and he'd be going by Marcus. And I found that kind of interesting too, because I was like, well, what is it? Is it Mark or is it Marcus? And I just went with Mark because it rolls off the tongue a little easier sometimes when you're recording, quite frankly. But I mean, he does go by Mark to this day, so may as well go with what he's currently calling himself.
Yeah, he's I'm sure he's working on his next indictment.
very quickly, back to what you said about the NASA thing, I had to laugh because after our last chat, I was just doing a little bit of snooping on Facebook, and, you know, I caught up with where the rest of the Schrenkers are at now, and one of his sons, who's now an adult, was actually posing in front of some display that had to do with NASA. And I thought, oh, I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, eh?
Yeah, let's hope he's, I wonder how all of his kids are doing.
Yeah, well, the daughter's estranged from both him and Michelle. And I guess Michelle, based on what the daughter had said in the one article, Michelle essentially kicked her out of the house. And from what the daughter was saying, she had a lot of conflict with the brothers. Now, when you go onto Michelle's Facebook, it's all pictures of Michelle and the sons, nothing of the daughters. You go onto Mark's Facebook, every so often he'll post a picture of the daughter and say, missing you, blah, 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 blah. Which leads me to believe that it's the daughter who doesn't want anything to do with Mark, rather than, unless Mark is just trying to post the picture of his daughter for sympathy, which I wouldn't that past him either.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
But it's interesting to me that he would even bring her up when, by the daughter's account, the two parents don't want anything to do with her.
Well, who knows?
Yeah.
Family.
Family. Yeah.
Well, so yeah, how long, so are you going to start posting more? I mean, your channel's got like over 50,000 subscribers.
It's doing pretty well. For
somebody who sounds like it's just a hobby, you know, like, I mean, you got 50,000 subscribers. That video's got a ton of views in just a few days.
I would love nothing more than to be able to do this full time. It all comes down to the financial side, right? Like, you got bills to pay. So, and like, I'd like to be in my career that I went to school for 6 years for. But at the end of the day, if YouTube video making makes more money or leads to more lucrative things, like, it's funny because I never expect this to happen. But I've heard friends who are YouTubers or have really big channels, and then I see comments on their pages. It's like, oh, Netflix should give you a deal. And I always think to myself, wouldn't that be the dream of getting like Netflix money to basically produce 6 to 8 episodes in a year, and that's what I do full time. That's like a dream come true. But at this stage of the game, it's still something that's kind of hobby, something I take seriously. Like, it's something that I want to do well at doing. I want to produce things that people are going to watch 2-3 years from now. Like, there's a lot of what are called content mills on YouTube, where it's just somebody who basically reads a Wikipedia article, slaps very rudimentary stock footage on it, calls it a day, posts it, and they do that every day. And they get tons of views, but they always peter out after a year or two. I'm going on my 5th year of doing this, and each year I've seen growth, rather than, oh, I did really well in the beginning and now everything's petered off and I don't even break 1,000 views per video.
That's right.
I would rather have that stable foundation to build on than to just content mill stuff, because I know that after a year or two I would be burnt out of that.
Right.
So, that's the hope. Like, I would love to get into more writing or video editing, but it's all going to come down to what the audience wants. If the audience shows that they want more videos by way of watching my stuff and that continuous engagement and interaction, and, you know, putting more money to make better videos in the long run is something that they would value, then yeah, by all means, I'd love to do that. But at the moment, I'm one guy, right? So
right. So, but your goal is ultimately you'd like it if this would pay off. So you,
oh, I would love it.
Be doing it, yeah,
yeah. Even if it were the kind of thing that like I got a good run, the way that like, you know, those people that have like a million subscribers on YouTube, they have a good run for 5 or 10 years of it, and then they retire from it and go and do something else. I would be perfectly okay with that too. But the end goal of it, it would be lovely, lovely, lovely to make that kind of money where I could support myself full time off of it and not have to live basically like a pauper doing something that they love, but like, you know, the struggling artist kind of thing. I'm past that point in my life of being the struggling artist. I want to have a family and take care of them and stuff like that. So it's definitely something that I want to do in the long run, but if it doesn't pan out, I have other stuff that I can fall back on, right? So, but hey, let's hope that this year I break 100,000.
Yeah.
I at least want to get that silver plaque. That's one thing, like the plaque that YouTube gives you. I would love to have one of those. So that would be...
How silly, like, here's the thing. Like, I thought that was so silly.
Yeah.
I did. And then we got the plaque and I was it's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
I was like, fuck that plaque. Care about that plaque. And then we got close and I was like, ooh, and then we got the plaque and I was like, I got the plaque.
Being the guy that like, you know, you grow up, maybe you come from a working class family. I don't need a BMW. BMWs are for assholes, blah, blah, blah. And then one day you can afford a BMW and you're like,
I got to get the BMW.
I got to get the BMW.
Yeah. And what's funny is, you know, people walk into the studio and they'll be like, oh, wow, you got your plaque. You got a plaque. That's right. You got over. And I'm like it, the fact that it means something to people was so silly to me. And then, you know, but then once you get into it and you're into YouTube and you start paying attention, you're like, no, that's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
Like, that's a milestone. So, you know,
I have 2 university degrees that I sometimes have up on the wall, sometimes don't. I would almost feel it's a bigger, like anybody can go to university and get a degree, but to have, to be able to say, I have 100,000 people that when I post submit on a video, they'll be there and ready to watch it. That's a good point of pride to have, that you can entertain 100,000 people at any given time or have their attention. That's something to be very proud of, I think.
I wish 100,000 people were watching my videos. It'd be great if it really worked like that. But so I've got about close to 180,000 that, you know, and only a fraction of them are watching the video.
I always find it's about whatever your subscriber count is, you can guarantee about 10% of that will be there for the opening of a video.
Yeah.
That'd be great. I get 10% of that number, then I'm happy with that.
And I would be thrilled with 10%.
Yeah.
I'm getting 5. Well, I'm getting 5 to 10%. So, I mean, some of the videos get more. So, I mean, on average, I'm getting about 5%, which is, you know, it's okay. Like, it's okay. Like, I'm happy that it's doing that the channel's doing well.
Yeah, it's a great channel.
So, all right. Well, anything else you want to? So, I'm going to put the link. Obviously, we'll put the link in the description box so that anybody can click on the link. Actually, you know what I'll try and do. If especially it'd be great if you remind me at the very end of the video right now, we'll put the link, I think I can put your channel.
Cool. Yeah.
And I can put the video that we've been talking about that you can just so the person can click it right now at the video. It should show up and you just click on it and it'll bring you right there. Or the subscribe. Well, you could also subscribe once you get to the video, but either way. So yeah, that might work too. And I'll also put the link in the description.
Yeah, thank you. That'd be great. And again, earlier on when I was talking about how I got started, if I ramble, feel free to just chop that up.
No, it's fine. I think it's fine.
It's something that I know the history of where I got to, but until it's actually coming out of my mouth, it's like, oh yeah, well, then that happened. And, you know, I was working in a gift shop when I started writing my scripts. Probably shouldn't have been doing that on the clock, but if you're going to stick me in a gift shop when I wanted to be a tour guide, then that's what I'm going to do, whatever. And 5 years later, who cares?
But well, did you ever, so on, I want to say it's Apple. There's a series called, it's called Silo.
Okay.
But it's based on the book Wool. Now, Wool was the first commercially successful self-published book on Amazon.
Oh, okay. Right. Interesting. So,
and the guy that wrote it had written, he'd gotten a publishing deal before for a science fiction book. Mm-hmm. He published it, got a real publishing deal. The book bombed. He then wrote Wool, and nobody was interested. They're like, yeah, the last book bombed. Like, okay. So he, at the same time, self-publishing. Amazon was coming out, right? KDP was coming out, and you could self-publish your books. Well, when he wrote these books, he was working as a librarian.
Interesting.
And he's like, and I had time. Like, I had time to write. So there's not a ton, you're not going to believe this, but a ton of people don't use libraries. Like, they're funded, but people don't really use them.
So he had downtime.
Right. So he's taking notes. He's writing. He ends up writing it and he self-publishes it. Well, first he's publishing excerpts of it on a blog. And then people are like, oh, you got to put this into a book. So he makes an entire book, which was his plan. He makes this entire book. It's called Wool. And unless you read the book, you don't really understand it. Obviously, YouTube realized that's not a good note. We're going to go with Silo. Because these people are living in a silo.
Yeah.
And we're talking about, it did very well. It blew up.
That's awesome.
And there was a huge article when I was locked up that I had read about it. There was a couple articles, but one of them I read, and it talked about how, like, I don't know, like the owner or the whatever, the managing editor or whoever it is, the president of like something like Simon & Schuster or Penguin or something, contacted him and said, look, we're willing to give you, I think it was like $1 million for the rights to the book, for the print rights to put it in stores. And he said, let's see, I'm making $80,000 a month right now. And he said, and it's climbing.
Yeah.
He goes, so why would I take your million to walk away? He said, when in 11 months from now, 12 months, I'll have that million.
Yeah.
And I've already made half a million. Like, it had been like 6 months. He's like, I've already made close to half a million because it was steadily going up. And so they came back and they said, okay, we'll give you, they never really tell what the number is. For the print rights, you can keep the self-publishing rights. For the Kindle, for the print on demand, we want the rights to print the books and put them in bookstores. And they gave him a smaller reduced price, which was out of his, he's like, which I couldn't do anyway.
Yeah.
You're going to give me a bunch of money for the right to something that I don't have the rights to, that I can't do myself. So it was one of the first books, and it was massively huge. But it's so funny, too, because they optioned the film rights.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all these, some big company came in and optioned the film rights, and then it never got made. 15 years went by before it finally got made.
Incredible.
That's just how long it takes.
Yeah.
And you know, but this guy, so I've been watching, I watched the first season, only one season. It's fucking amazing. It's a great story. But you know, this is a guy who had failed and kept going and was honest. It was he turned his side gig into something phenomenal. I mean, I love that. I love those guys who, like, hey, I'm gonna do this on the side, maybe it turns into something, maybe it doesn't. And he actually failed once already. Failed so badly nobody wanted to give him a second chance. And he said, and instead of him saying, oh well, then I'll just be a librarian, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, instead he was like, yeah, I'm gonna keep trying.
That's the kind of mentality I always try to have. Like, every once in a while, I'll have a video that comes out and it bombs, and I won't be able to figure out why. Like, I did one on a guy called Dr. Chaos, who was basically this computer nerd who took over the subways in Chicago over a Saturday night. He shut everything down. And then they found, like, his little hideaway that he had. Basically, the reason that he shut it down is because they found him... He was basically an urban explorer. They caught him with cyanide on his body that he had stolen out of an abandoned factory, and he just kept it with him because he thought it was cool. He was basically like an overgrown man child by the sounds of it. But it shut down the subway because they went and they found that he had actually the storage room that he had taken over, changed the locks on, and had all this computer hacking equipment and all kinds of stuff. And they basically thought he was going to be the next Ted Kaczynski, when he was never going to be the next Ted Kaczynski. He was like just some nerd that liked to pal around with his friends and go spelunking and all that stuff, and found chemicals and kept them on him because he thought that made him cool. But they basically made a huge mountain out of a molehill, and it was a really interesting story. And it got, I think, like 15,000 views. It wasn't a popular video. And then I did one on like the coolest cooler, which was this Kickstarter campaign to create this cooler that basically was just souped up a little. And it was a very cut and dried story of the guy overpromised, underdelivered, and then didn't give anybody their money back. I didn't think it was it wasn't the most interesting story I've ever covered, but for some reason that one got 100,000 views and I couldn't figure it out. Having those two contrasts, it would be very easy to throw your hands up in the air and be like, I can't figure this out. I'm just gonna phone it in, basically. But I don't like that idea. There's a book I read called The Perennial Seller. It's by a guy named Ryan Holiday, and it basically walks you through, like the story you were just telling me with that silo, how that happens and how artists go back to the drawing board and they don't give up and don't just resign themselves to being a librarian or whatever, and they keep going, and it's perseverance in the end that pays off. And that's something I always, like, if anybody ever says to me, if I want to get 50,000 views on YouTube like you have, or 50,000 subscribers, what should I do? And I basically tell them, keep making stuff and always try and do a little bit better than the last time, and you'll get there.
Right.
Are there people that have 15 videos on their entire channel and millions of subscribers and millions of views? Sure. But what I would say is, what were they doing before they made that channel that gave them the tools that they needed to be able to hit the ground running with that? I basically came into making my channel with skills I picked up in high school and working at a TV station for 3 months, and the ability to research based off of getting the same 4-year degree in history that anybody could get with a little bit of elbow grease. So I kind of started from a foundation of not really knowing what I'm doing and just going ahead. Now I would say my videos are much better produced, they're much better researched, and it took that 5 years. But what I'm excited about is, where could I be in 5 years from now? And maybe I'll have a different YouTube channel that I start that only has 5 videos before it hits 1 million views or whatever. Maybe not. Maybe I'll stick with what I'm doing. The point is, you got to persevere. You always have to set yourself to that. Okay, that little bit of daily increase. And
All right. So let's wrap it up.
Great conversation. So going back to my very first video, the Kazuo Nagano story, that's a video that, because I'm heading up on my 5 years of having the channel, it's something I actually want to go back and research. Even if I don't put together a new video, or if I do something for Patreon exclusive or whatever, I want to go back and revisit that story based off of the skills I have now. So if you're ever interested in talking about that story, about this Japanese fraudster who got murdered in front of 30 people because he was caught scamming the elderly, and it was on national television, him literally getting stabbed in his apartment. You can hear the screams, and all the TV reporters are just standing there listening to it happen. It's a very interesting story how he built it up. And there's also some cult-like elements. So if you're ever interested in chatting about that, I'd be more than willing to. But yeah, this was fun. I don't get on podcasts very often, but I always have a great time. So thank you for this opportunity.
Hey, I really appreciate you guys watching the video. Do me a favor, hit the subscribe button, hit the bell so you get notified of videos just like this. Also, do me a favor, please consider joining my Patreon. I am going to leave the link to Anomaly Docs, Anomaly Docs, the YouTube channel. And we're also going to put up the, whatever they call that, logo. And we'll put up the video about Marcus Schrenker. And I really appreciate you guys watching. See ya.